The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Blessed are you, God, King Universe. Asher kidishanu mitzvotav. You who have sanctified us through your mitzvot, through your commandments, v'tzivanu lasok b'divrei Torah. And you have commanded us to be involved in your words of Torah. Now, what would I have expected this blessing to say? I mean, this is the blessing I am making before I study Torah. Each day I should try and study some Torah. So today I make a blessing over the Torah. What would I have expected this blessing to say? La'asok b'divrei Torah? What does la'asok mean? It means to be involved, to be occupied, right? Okay? If the phone is busy, right? You're trying to get through to your friend and it's asuk, that means it's busy, right? Can't get through. And so we are being commanded here to be busy and involved and preoccupied with Torah. Now this is very strange, because we would have expected it to say, Lilmud Torah. We would think the mitzvah is to study Torah, right? And it should have said, you have commanded us to study Torah. And that's not what it says. It says, you have commanded us to be involved in Torah. So I'd like to try and understand what that means. What's the difference between studying Torah and being involved in Torah? Now, one of the things I try to help people, especially people who are just new in meeting Torah, is to clarify how important it is to understand your expectations. You know, very often people get really down or disappointed because their expectations are wrong, right? I mean, imagine a fellow who's really excited, wants to go to some rock concert, and unknowingly walks into the Jerusalem Theater when the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra was playing. He will probably be a little bit disappointed, right? Now everybody else around is probably really happy because they're getting what they came to get. So if you know what you're trying to get, and that's in fact what's being offered, you should be basically happy. That makes sense, right? Well, the problem today with Jews just starting in Jewish learning, and unfortunately this happens for many Jews who have even been learning for a long time, that they don't really have an understanding of what is it that you're offering me, right? What is it that you're offering me? There's a cute little story that I remember when I was just getting involved in Judaism about the dove. They say that in the early stages, I guess, of the evolution of the dove, that the dove didn't have wings. It only walked, right? And it had tremendous conflict and problems with a lion. The lion used to run after the dove, and the dove used to barely get away from the lion. But you know, every day, day in, day out, he's got to run away from this lion. It was very difficult. So the dove starts to pray to God. It says, please God, can't you help me? I'm this poor little dove. I can barely outrun this lion. Please help me. All right. So sure enough, what happens? One morning, the dove wakes up. His prayers are answered, and he's got wings. Wow! Check these wings. Wow! He's so excited. He can't believe it. He's feeling so confident that he's walking down the street. He sees the lion. Now, he doesn't care. He's fine. He goes, hey, pussycat! Over here. I'm not afraid of this guy. I got wings! So he waits to let the lion kind of start charging after him, get a little closer, so he can show him what he is now able to do. And so as this lion starts to approach him, and the dove is kind of standing there patiently waiting, right? Then he sees the lion come closer and closer, and he goes, ha! And he starts running down the street, right? Starts running down the street. But he doesn't understand what's going on, because generally he could run much faster. But with these wings, he doesn't know what's going on. Why is this more difficult to run? And sure enough, the lion's coming closer and closer, and he's trying to run faster and faster, but it's just impossible, and he's tripping over these things, and he doesn't understand what's going on. And I don't want to tell you the rest of the story. It's a sad story. I don't want you to go home tonight and have dreams about this bird. But basically, the bird got basically caught, let's put it that way, with this lion. And the bird was really devastated. He was probably also dead. But besides that, that's not what's important. It was his feelings. And so this bird starts, he gets to heaven. By the way, this is factual material that I have documented. So he gets to heaven, and the God is there, and he says to God, I don't understand. I pray to you. I ask for help. And this is what you do to me? You give me these wings that make life more difficult, and I'm tripping over them, and they're heavier? So, of course, Hashem says to him, Dove. Probably said, Dovele. Said, Dovele. I didn't give you those wings to run with. I gave you those wings to fly with. You see, we have a tendency to assume that everything that comes into our life is exactly like or similar to other things that have come into our lives. And to really be completely open, to see something for the first time, to realize that this is unlike anything else that I've ever seen or known. All that bird knew what to do was to run. He didn't know there could be something else completely different, which is to fly. Now, you know, this little story reminds me of a Gemara. You know, in the times of the Romans, of course, the Jewish people were not allowed to perform mitzvot. And actually, it was the time of the Greeks. It was the time of Romans too. But this story took place in the time of the Greeks. And there was a Jewish fellow he put on tefillin, which of course was a violation of the law. And a Greek soldier saw him and started running after him. Right? And he caught him in a corner. And as this Jew is running, he starts taking off his tefillin. Right? And he's running down the alley and he's holding his tefillin in his hand. Finally, he's cornered. And the Greek soldier says, Jew, hand over. I know what those are. Hand them over. Open your hands. And the Gemara says that this Jewish fellow opened up his hands, and it was a dove. It was a dove. So what does that mean? In fact, there's a law, a halakha. It's not so much of a halakha, it's more like a custom, that when we wrap our tefillin and put them away, we wrap them up in a way that they look like a little dove with wings. Right? What it's really telling us is that the mitzvot and the Torah are wings to fly with. But you see, if a person doesn't understand that, if a person picks up the Torah and they really have no understanding of what it's offering and their expectations, it's that it is somehow similar to everything else they have been studying or they've been looking for, they're going to miss its point. So my point over here is that one must always ask themselves, are my expectations attuned to the reality? To the reality. Because otherwise, and I've seen this happen, people come into a yeshiva and they look at the people sitting there studying Torah and they can't understand why they're so happy or why they're enjoying it. And they pick it up and they read it and it just does, it's almost like walking into a movie theater, which is really a three-dimensional movie, and everybody else is wearing these little plastic glasses which lets you see the three dimension. And everyone in the movie is going, wow, great, wow. And you're sitting beside this person and you say, what's going on? I mean, it's distorted. If you ever look at these three-dimensional movies without the plastic glasses, it's just total distortion. You feel something's wrong there. So to try and understand what really the Torah is offering, to try and understand what the Torah is offering, I had a cute story from Rabbi Refson. Rabbi Refson is the head of Neve Yerushalayim. He was on a plane. He was on a plane. And sitting next to him was an astrophysicist, a world-renowned astrophysicist. A Jewish fellow. Who else, right? A Jewish fellow. And he starts talking to Rabbi Refson, who's also got his PhD. And he turns to Rabbi Refson and he says, Rabbi, I believe all of Judaism could be summed up in just a few words. I mean, imagine the chutzpah of this guy. You're talking to a rabbi who's been studying Torah for maybe 30, 40 years, and I think I could sum up all of Torah in a few words. Rabbi Refson looked at him in a little bit of a shock, and he said, yes, professor. He said, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. That's it.
right?
Ah, Rabbi Revson strokes his beard. Ah, very nice, very nice. He then turns to the professor. He says, you know, professor, I think all of astrophysics could be summed up in a few words. So he says, really? You know? He says, yes. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. How I wonder how you are. I mean, to have the audacity to think that Torah is so simple and it's just so easy and that one could just, with a few words, pass it off as if I know what it is. So when we're studying this particular passage, it's a very concise meditation that really captures the essence of what is Torah learning really all about. Because if I don't have the right approach, I'm going to miss it completely. And I'm sorry to say that I've seen this for people who've come to Torah. They do not have their expectations straight. No one, unfortunately, has perhaps helped them get their expectations straight. And then they get dissatisfied, they get turned off, or whatever. So the first thing to understand is nobody studies Torah around here. There's no reason to study Torah. According to this bracha, there's no mitzvah to study Torah. You want to study something? You can go to university, and that's an important thing to do. However, Torah is not something you study. Torah is something you get involved in. It's a very different thing. La'asok b'divrei Torah, to be involved in Torah, is very different than l'ilmud Torah, to study. What's the difference? What's the difference? Well, there's an interesting Rambam. Maimonides has a very important halakha. And it's very, very fascinating. It says that really, ideally, one should not pay to study Torah. They shouldn't pay to study Torah. Why? Because the verse says, Torah morashat kihilat Yaakov. Right? That the Torah of Moses is an inheritance for the community, for the community of the congregation of Israel, of Yaakov. So it's a morasha. It's an inheritance. You don't pay for inheritance, right? It's yours. You don't have to pay for inheritance. And therefore, halachically, the ideal is one would not have to pay to study Torah. However, the Rambam explains, but what if you cannot find somebody who has the time to be teaching you Torah for free? All right? This person needs to be compensated. They could be doing other things. And if they're going to take time to be learning with you, well, so then what are they going to do? So what if you cannot find someone who is wealthy enough and independent enough that they have the time to be teaching you Torah without needing some kind of compensation? Well, it's not the ideal. It's called Bidi Evid. You can pay. And the Rambam brings a proof from a pasuk, Kone Emet. You should buy truth. Oh, fantastic verse. One is allowed to buy truth. Then the Rambam continues like this. He says, however, you who have had to kind of do the not ideal, you who is now paid to study Torah, should not think that you have the initial right to ask somebody else for money. Do you hear this? In other words, the Rambam is suggesting that a person would think, well, if I paid for it, well, then now I can basically ask money for it. Now, that sounds a little strange. That sounds a little strange. I mean, why would I think that? Who knows better than I? I looked all over the place. I tried to find somebody who had the time to teach me without needing some kind of compensation financially. I couldn't find such a person. I knew it wasn't the ideal. Why in the world would I think, just because I paid for it, I now have the right initially, right, without any qualms, to now expect somebody to pay me to teach them what I learned? I mean, that sounds a little strange. What is the Rambam? Why does the Rambam assume, without thinking that this person is just being a little, you know, obnoxious, well, I paid, then somebody better pay me too. Must be something more to it, right? I think this is what the Rambam's saying. You know, the truth is that Torah is not truth. Now, listen quickly before you think I'm an apikoros, right? Torah is not truth. There's something much greater than truth. There's life. Surely, life includes truth. Truth is definitely a component in life. It's a quality in full life. But life is greater than just truth. Although truth is one of its ingredients, but life is much greater than that. Torah is much more than truth. It's life. It's called an Eitz Chaim Hila Machazikim Ba. It's a tree of life. So the Rambam is saying this. The Rambam is saying, you really shouldn't have to pay for it, ideally, because it is a morasha. It's an inheritance. It's yours. You shouldn't have to pay for what's yours. Ah, but what if you cannot find somebody who's going to teach it to you in that way? Well, then you can buy truth. And you'll get the truth aspect of Torah, because you can buy truth. And now that you feel you've only bought truth, you feel you have the initial right to sell truth, because you're feeling, well, I got the truth of Torah, but then I get the life of Torah. So what is the life of Torah? What does it mean that Torah is an Eitz Chaim Hi? It's a life. And when a person's involved in Torah, it's Tzama Chaim, it's an elixir of life. What makes this book life? In contrast to other books, which are just truth. There's lots of terrific books out there. And lots of books who have truth in them. But this has life in it. And what's the difference between truth and life? Truth is information. And anybody could give you information. Some better, some worse. But information is truth. Life is an experience. No one can transmit to you life by virtue of some kind of information. Life is something you have to taste. It's like chocolate cake. I cannot tell you the truth about chocolate cake. I mean, I could tell you the truth of chocolate cake. It's made of sugar, and it's made of eggs, and it's made of flour. That's the truth quality. And I could tell you the truth about chocolate cake. But the life experience of chocolate cake, that is only if you taste it, if you eat it. And so too, Torah. Torah is more than truth. It's a living encounter with God. And explain that right now. You see, what happened at Sinai wasn't simply an opportunity to gain some kind of truth. You know, there are certain philosophers who believed that the reason why, not Jewish philosophers, the reason why there was an encounter at Sinai is because man at that point wasn't sufficiently evolved to know the truth. Someone had to tell them the truth. But today, for instance, now that we're so evolved, right? The Sinai experience wouldn't have been necessary. Because morality and ethics are things that we all can come to recognize on our own. And there are some philosophers of that opinion. Now that's really a mistaken understanding of what happened at Sinai. To think that all that was important about Sinai is that truth was communicated is really ripping Sinai off. Because what happened at Sinai was a living encounter with God. Has it ever been, the verse says, that I have spoken to a nation face to face? And what happened at Sinai was a face to face encounter with Hashem. It's not just the information that's important, although the information is very important, but that meeting. That meeting. You know, someone could tell you everything you think you'd like to know about this potential shidduch. You still don't know, right? Until you meet them. And then even after you meet them, it just doesn't boil down to a bunch of facts and information. There's a certain exchange that happens that just cannot be captured in words. Right? In words. So what happened at Sinai is not only a revelation of truth, but more important, a revelation of love. At Sinai, we met Hashem face to face. To face. And the pasuk that says that the Torah is a morasha, it's a inheritance. The sages tell us that morasha also is a hint to morasa. And morasa means an engagement. that the Torah is more than simply information. It's almost as if the ring of Hashem to the Jewish people. It was an engagement. It was like a chuppah. And if you look at the Midrashim around the Sinai experience, it describes it like a chuppah, like a wedding with a bride and a groom. It's a whole different thing. Completely different thing. And so, you know, they once asked Einstein. You probably know him, right? Nice Yiddish boy. So Einstein was once asked, with all that you have discovered and clarified, what question do you still feel left in your mind that you would like to have resolved? You wonder, what would Einstein say? And this is what he said. He said, and you know, first of all, the foundation of his unified field theory was based on, I don't believe God plays dice with the universe. That's a very famous saying that Einstein said. That he doesn't believe the universe is a dice game. But then listen to what he now says. He says, I want to know, is the universe friendly? What an interesting thing to say. Is the universe friendly? I know that the universe, this manifestation of intelligence, I know that the universe is a manifestation of intelligence, but is the universe a manifestation of friendship? Friendship. You see, you know, you can't philosophize about friendship. Either you've had it or you haven't. You know, in other words, a scientist can measure the universe, articulate it with such brilliance and accuracy, formulating the principles that underline the physical world. But will you ever have the ability to put friendship and love under a microscope? I mean, that'll be the saddest thing. I remember I was in an airport and I saw one of the national magazines front cover, the scientific explanation of love. Yuck. Right? If you give me a scientific explanation of love, I'm out of here. You know? That'd be horrible. And I don't know if I ever shared this with you, but I met a fellow who was not exactly very spiritually accepting. And we had this discussion about spirituality. He was very anti-spirituality and denied it having any real significance or substance. So I turned to him and I said, well, but, I mean, then how would you describe your relationship with your wife? And he said, neural impulses. So I turned to him and I said, have you ever shared that with her? You know, that's really romantic, isn't that? You know, some beautiful evening when the moon is shining really terrific and you're by the sea. Why don't you turn to her and say, sweetheart, you're a terrific neural impulse. Right? She probably turned to her and says, you're a real nerd also. I mean, do you really think there isn't a dimension, a real quality to love and relationship? You see, what happened at Sinai is an encounter with God. And only if you've experienced that can you know that. That's the problem with trying to prove God. Because trying to prove God may succeed in helping you access an idea, a God concept. But where's God? A concept? And therefore, as one Jewish philosopher said, you know, in Judaism, there are no proofs for God, just witnesses. And in our lives, we witness that encounter. And when we witness that encounter, we know it's true. That's the difficulty, you know. You can't argue with someone's experience. If it stays on the purely rational, intellectual level, which is fine, you know, so you can have big discussions and debates. But if you experience something, then no matter what a person says, you've experienced it. And the Jewish people are saying that what happened at Sinai, they experienced it. They experienced it. And that experience is our experience. It's something within us. If we're even to borrow the Jungian concept of the collective unconscious, then we are born with an inner knowledge of this experience. We have tasted this experience. I just heard today a beautiful, beautiful teaching from Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach, Zichner Levacha. He says, you know, sometimes when you're yearning for something, It's because you don't have it. So that's why you want it. But that's not Torah. We yearn for Torah not because we don't have it. It's because we do have it. We have it inside of ourselves. We know what it tastes like, and we're yearning to get it back, to find that which we know inside we have, but we haven't been able to really bring out. And so, philosophy is not the way you make friends. Unless you talk about philosophy with your friends. But you can't philosophize about a friend. You only experience a friend. Truth you can buy. Love, well, we know the verse, can't buy me love. Right? Can't buy me love. It's from the Beatles. Okay. So what is inherent in the Torah? What's inherent in the Torah is the Shekhinah. When a person's involved in the Torah, well then what Torah is saying is you're going to have an experience with the Shekhinah, with the Divine Presence. Right here, right now. It's a completely different thing. When I open up a biology book, I'm not expecting to meet the Shekhinah in this book. Right? When I open up a geographical book, National Geographic, I'm not expecting to meet the Shekhinah in this book. And so therefore I can study these books. And it's terrific. And there's very important information in these books. However, when I open up the Torah, then I want to meet the author. And you have to understand, this is a very, very important distinction between Torah and any other books. Because very often, I won't say always, but very often, people are not so concerned with the author of the book. The book is important because it has information, and I'd like to get that information, and I got that information, and I'm not so concerned with who wrote this book. I mean, it might be nice to know. If I've read a couple of their books, well, that might be interesting facts. But the truth is, the book is important in and of itself, regardless of who this author is. I remember when I was in high school, and we had all these textbooks, you know, which are all these books that are giving us the truths on life, so to speak. And you know, I never knew who wrote any of these books. I simply remembered that they were published by somebody that started with the initials Mick. They're all Mick somebody. Mick Master, Mick Millen, McDonald's, I don't know. Right? But the concern for who the author was not so important in these textbooks, the way it was delivered to me anyways. And so it's important to understand that when we open up a biology book, well, the information is important irregardless of the author. Irregardless of the author. But when we open up the Torah, we want to know the author. We want to meet the author in this text right here, right now, and we're told that we can. In other words, the difference with Torah and other study would be other studies interested in having information, and I'm not in any way diminishing that as being important. It's just different. But when I open up Torah, I'm not looking to have, I'm looking to be in a relationship with the author through this book. In other words, when I open up the Torah, then the Torah is like a love letter. Now let's think of what happens when we get a love letter. You know, I'm sitting there, let's say my life experience, I'm in yeshiva, I'm sitting there and I'm having lunch, and they drop in front of me a letter. I don't believe it. It's a letter from the one I love. Well, surely as I'm eating, surely I rip open the envelope and I start to speed read through this letter. Nah, of course not, right? I'm going to save this letter. I'm going to read this letter in a very special place. Because this letter deserves more. Oh, come on, it's just information. No, no. Okay, so I go to a nice special place. I open up the letter. I start to read this letter from my beloved. And what do I hear? The voice of my beloved. And I hear their voice. As I'm reading it, I kind of hear them speaking it. And then I feel their presence. Do you remember that experience, opening up a letter from someone? And you open up and all of a sudden, it's as if they're right there. Their presence is right there. And so you read this letter once, and you rip it up. Nah. You don't rip it up, right? You say, ooh, the first time I read it, I was only getting pshat. The simple meaning of this letter. But now I'm going to go over this letter, because I know there's much more to this letter. So I open up this letter, and I say, well, first of all, she told me about the weather. And then she starts talking about her mother. What's the connection? There's Akasha here. What's Rashi say on this letter? And I begin to do drushes on this letter. And I do the drush on the letter. And then that's not the end. I pick the letter up again. And now I'm going through this letter again. And now, there are hints in this letter. There's hints in this letter. That's not only what she says and the way she structured her sentences, but look at those T's. They're so high up and they're crossed on the other side of the page. And look at those G's, how they're just coming down so low. And my gosh, and look at the slant. And there's hints in this letter. And that's called remes. And then you go over it again. Because you realize, wait a second, this is much deeper than that. There's secrets in these letters. This is a secret. And you start looking for the Kabbalah in the letter. And you start counting every 49 letters. And it spells, don't count my letters, please. And you say, there's a secret in this letter. And then, of course, after you've gone through all that, you rip it up and throw it away. No. How many people here actually save letters? Look at all these weird people. Taking a piece of paper with meaningless squiggles of worthless ink. Why can't I throw that letter away? Do I plan to publish it when these people pass away? God forbid. Some people are going, yes, I do. I do. Go in my memoirs. No, it's because we sense the presence of the beloved within this piece of paper. Well, so in a manner of speaking, this is Torah. The Torah has the presence, a holy special presence. And when I read the Torah, I'm not going to access that presence. It's like somebody reading my mail, which isn't very nice. You know, if you read a letter from my beloved, are you going to get their presence? No way, you're just reading it. For you, it could only be information. You say, hey, let me read that. It's just not the same thing, right? I don't read these letters. I get involved. And through this letter, I meet my beloved without thinking my beloved is in this letter. And so Torah is not something you study. Torah is something we get involved in to hear that voice, to feel that presence, to experience that love. Through this text, that's what Torah claims. Then nobody can say that's true or not unless they're willing to experience it. You know, I can say it's chocolate cake, but unless I put it in my mouth and ready to eat it, I don't know. And so it's important to understand, when I'm learning Torah, I've got to be involved. I've got to really put myself into the Torah. And you know, what's the difference between Einstein and Breishis Bara Elokim et Hashamayim v'et Ha'aretz? And in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. I mean, they both seem to be addressing creation of the world, structure of the universe. Now, if a scientist were to open up Breishit, they might not be so impressed. They might feel, oh, please, you know, if I'm really looking for an accurate description of the process of creation, or how the world came to be, this just doesn't speak to me. I mean, it's just not scientifically, it sounds like a fable, right? Now, okay, you have books like Genesis and the Big Bang, which demonstrates how much of science actually is hidden or expressed in this. But, you know, still, without drushes, you look at it and you feel this is a cute little story for children. God said this and God said that. You see, if a person's looking to Torah as if it's a science book, they're going to be basically disappointed. Because the Torah wasn't written to be a science book. There's good science books. Surely I believe Kula Ba, everything's in Torah. But I still have to ask myself, but essentially what is it that I'm looking for when I open up the Torah? Am I looking for science? Well, then maybe I should open up science books. Am I looking for psychology? Right? Well, maybe I should be looking at Freud or Adler. And this, I'm afraid, is one of the problems, and also I'm afraid is a bit of a problem in terms of, so to speak, how Torah is being marketed these days. That very often, Torah is being marketed as, this is a better psychology book than all the other psychology books that you're reading. Right? But, you know, I find that to be slightly problematic and setting people up with the wrong expectations. Right? Because if I'm led to believe that somehow this book, the five books of Moses, is a better Dale Carnegie, right, then I'm going to be eventually disappointed. Because if I'm looking for Dale Carnegie, you know, I really don't have to commit myself so much for Dale Carnegie to be in my life. And what Dale Carnegie has to say about improving my life and being happier and making friends and influencing people, terrific stuff, right? But it's not Torah. Chachma b'goyim ta'amin. There's wisdom by the goyim. So if I start trying to shortchange people by letting them think that what I'm going to give you is a better version of all these other books, it's problematic. It's problematic because then a person, well, then I don't need so much commitment over here and I don't have to do all this requirements over here. And, you know, it's a big problem. Torah is about dveikut. It's about bonding with a higher reality. That's what it's about. And unless I'm honest with myself with that, I'm going to miss the whole point of it. The whole point of it. And so when I'm learning Torah l'shma for its sake, I'm learning Torah in order for myself to have that bond with Hashem through that Torah experience. But if I'm learning it like some kind of philosophy or psychology book, so I can have a lot of information, it may be information that's good for my life, it's not Torah. It's not Torah. When a scientist looks at Torah, he's looking for science. There's science in it, but that's not what's special about it. When we are involved in Torah, then we want to know what Hashem wants to tell us about creation. Why is it important for my relationship to Hashem to read these words, in the beginning God created heaven and earth? Do you follow this? Whenever I'm learning Torah, what I want to ask myself is what covenantal value? It's a Sefer Brit. It's a book of covenant. And therefore, what kind of covenantal value is in this book? Every verse, somehow, is giving me a way to plug into that covenant. And so, the way we learn Torah is not like some study, but it's through involvement. And I remember I saw a cute little cartoon. It was about a professor who walks into lecture, and in front of them was 30 students the first day of the year in college. The next day he walks in, there are 25 students and 5 tape recorders. The next day he walks in, there are 20 students, 10 tape recorders. And within a week of the course, the professor walks into the lecture hall, and lo and behold, in front of him is a large room filled with tape recorders. Well, did that bother the professor? Not at all. The professor took out of his pocket a tape recorder, placed it, and pressed play. Right? He has recordings of this stuff too. And it was really an electrifying experience. But it wasn't what Torah is all about. Now, let me tell you an amazing piece. I believe it's in the Zohar, but it might also be in the Gemara. There's a Rav who says, you know, had I gotten to class earlier, I would have known double what I know today. Well, so a fellow says, well, you were so late. I mean, you got there halfway in the class. He says, no. I always got there before he started. But the room was so full that the only place to sit was behind him. So I couldn't see his face. Had I seen his face, I would have known double what I know today. Now, what's that mean? It's a Gemara. But I think it's also in the Zohar. So it's important to understand. What does that mean to see the Rebbe's face? I mean, information is information. No. When we're involved in Torah right now, the Shekhinah is here. We should be feeling that presence. We should be opening ourselves up to that presence. And that's a whole different experience. I had a teacher who used to hold my hand when he would teach me. It's a completely different experience. And I remember the first time I walked into Beit Midrash, I was shocked. You're telling me that these people can study in this noise? I mean, you walk into a Beit Midrash, a learning hall, and people are going, it looks like people are yelling at each other. It looks like a war. You know? When you walk into a library, shh, okay. I'm just looking for a book. Shh. You know, like I can't concentrate. It's got to be absolutely quiet. Now, I remember when I went to a Beit Midrash for the first time, I said, I will never be able to concentrate in this place. Right? It's too noisy. The amazing thing is, the level of concentration goes up in these places, you know, especially when you yell very loud. It's a completely different room. It's not a room for concentration. It's much more than that. It's a room for relation. And there's a whole dynamic of relationship going on in this room, which is so special. That's how that wisdom comes flying in to our lives. So, lasok bidivrei Torah is not to study Torah. You want to study, there are places to study, and there are terrific topics that should be studied. But Torah, we get involved, because we want to meet the author through the Torah. Now, this is a very interesting idea. You know, one of the big problems that people have with Torah is how interpreted it is. I mean, isn't it so full of interpretations? I mean, one rabbi says this, and one sage says that, and one student says this. It just doesn't seem to have, anything really solid, because it seems to just go in any way. So what is the value of interpretation? When we pick up a book, what right do we have to interpret this book? So I was asked to read The Great Gatsby over the weekend to be discussed in class. All right, we got into class. And I remember the teacher getting up, and we were doing, I don't remember which chapter, and she said something, well, did you notice in this chapter the green light flashing across the bay? What is the meaning of the green light flashing across the bay? So I put up my hand. I said, well, I think Fitzgerald over here, he was probably sitting in his cottage. He was writing this chapter. He looked out of his window across the bay. He saw a green light flashing. He liked the way it looked. He threw it into the scene. The teacher said, David, wrong. And cut it out. I said, but how do you know? No, how do you know? No, I'll tell you what the green light was. Green light is go. Flashing is hesitation. Water is instability and yearning. I said, no. He was sitting in his cottage, and he was looking across. How do you know that's what he means? How do you know that's what he means? Well, she knew that's what it means. Anyways, I mean, that's how she communicated in the exam that I failed. So, you know, sometimes it's not worth arguing. But that's a good question. When we pick up a book, what right do we have to interpret this book? Unless the author tells me what he or she really intended, how could I know? I mean, how could I really know what's in this book? Right? Well, listen to this amazing thing about Torah. Because when you're involved in Torah, not studying it, not reading it, right? When you're involved in Torah, the author is telling you what it means. You know how the author is telling you what it means? Because there's a spark of author inside of you. The soul, the self, is a spark of the author. And so when I, as a neshama, Open up the Torah and get involved. What am I actually doing? I'm actually plugging into a level of prophetic reception. Now, I have to understand, there's prophecy, which is the highest level of reception. There's Ruach HaKodesh, which is a lower, but nonetheless, an inspiration. But learning Torah and saying Pshat is revelatory. And that's how we understand it. This is the text. And if I plug myself into this text, and I'm a holy, sacred person who follows this text and lives this text, which is a criteria to plug into this text, then what I'm getting is revelatory. And therefore, every single day, new Torah is being revealed in the world. Torah isn't simply an experience or a revelation that happened 3,500 years ago. Torah is an ongoing revelation, which each and every one of us has the possibility to plug into. Now that's an amazing thing. That's a very exciting thing. That's what I love. Because when you're creative in Torah, and you open up the Chumash, and you ask a question, and you look at a Rashi, and then you look at a Ramban, and then you look at the Midrash, and you're putting it all together, and all of a sudden something hits you. A flash. It's revelatory. You say a pshat. You get a sod. You get a secret. You get an understanding. Where did it come from? It's plugging into radio 613 on your dial, Sinai. That's really what happens when we learn Torah. Now, you see, people don't know this. So they don't even know how to turn the book on. You know, it's like, imagine you got a radio, you don't even know how to plug it in. You don't even know you're supposed to plug it in. I think one of the greatest ways to turn a person off to Judaism is have them read the Bible. That'll really get them running. You know, they'll be out of here fast. You read it. I mean, there's just so many problems if you read this book without really getting involved, really understanding what it is. But some brilliant marketer decided, you know, every hotel room should have a Gideon Bible right next to their bed, you know, just exactly where they'd like to find this Bible. You know, it's a crazy thing. It's a crazy thing. And people read the Bible when they're tired at night before they go to sleep. Is this a book you read before you go to sleep? It's a sad thing. The Bible is something maybe you can read, but Torah. You can't read Torah. You have to get involved in Torah. If you really want to understand what it's communicating. Therefore, the Zohar describes involvement with Torah as a loving relationship between a man and a woman. And the woman is initially behind a wall. But if he's ready and willing to be patient, she finally is revealed to him from behind a curtain. And if he's ready and he's willing and he's patient, she then reveals herself to him behind a lattice. And it's such a beautiful description. Anybody reading this would say, this is Torah? This is what we do in yeshiva? It's such a sensual description of this yearning for a connection as that connection becomes more and more revealed. Unbelievable piece. The Zohar says that essentially the Torah is one word. One word. What is that word? The name of Hashem. You know, there's a lot of different names of Hashem. One of the names of Hashem is the entire Torah. Now listen, amazing. The Zohar is essentially saying that when I'm involved in Torah, and I thought I was saying, Breishis bara Elokim et haShamayim v'et haAretz, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, I wasn't saying that at all. You know what I was really doing? I was calling. I was really saying, Hashem, Hashem, Hashem. That's really what I was doing. That's why it's called Mikra. Mikra means to call. And when I open up the Torah and don't read it, but I call Hashem into my life through it, then I create that kind of relationship. Completely different understanding. Therefore, the Rashbam, who was the grandson of Rashi. Now, Rashi was one of the greatest commentaries ever to live. He wrote so much commentary on such almost the entire spectrum of Judaism. And imagine he did it without word perfect, right? I mean, there's a man sitting there with a little feather and quilt. Okay, they said he had five daughters and they helped him, you know? But nonetheless, five daughters and Rashi producing Rashi's works is outrageous. So now Rashi has a grandson. His name is Rashbam. He's referred to as the Rashbam. And the Rashbam writes a commentary on the Torah. Little chutzpahdik, wouldn't you say? I mean, your grandfather, the great Rashi. And you're going to go ahead and write another interpretation of the Torah? And the Rashbam addresses this very issue and says, you're probably right, wondering why I, the grandson of Rashi, is writing an interpretation of the Torah. And he says, I am offering new understandings of Torah as they come into the world today. And this is a very important principle. New understandings of Torah are coming into the world today. Always. Every single day, we can access that broadcasting. Sinai is a broadcasting that's going on all the time. And one can tune into that. But it's through Torah. So Judaism claims. So let's go over what we learned. Torah is not something you study, you get involved. Torah is not a book. It's a meeting place. I want to meet the author. How the author is manifest through this text. And one is told they will experience the Shechina. Lasok b'divrei Torah is the first thing we need to know. Let's go on a little bit. Let's do it quickly. The next bracha, V'haravna Hashem Elokeinu. Please God, make your Torah sweet in our mouths, and in the mouths of the house of Israel, and we and our children, our children's children, will all know your name, and study Torah for its sake. Blessed are you who is teaching Torah in the present tense to his nation Israel. The first bracha tells us that our approach to Torah must be a desire for involvement. The second bracha tells us something amazing. We are praying to God that the Torah be sweet. Now what kind of thing is that? Torah sweet. Torah is going to be sweet. How does Torah become sweet? Well, what makes something sweet? Isn't sweet in taste somewhat relative? I mean, for instance, my daughter, she doesn't like candy so much. She likes olives. So when she's in shul, and all the kids go to the candy man, she'd look at the candy man with these big brown eyes and say, don't you have olives? You know? For her, that's sweet. That's tasty. It's very relative. How in the world could I be praying to God that the Torah should be sweet? So what does it mean to make the Torah sweet? I want this Torah to relate to me. I have this expectation that Torah could actually relate to me personally, and I could find it sweet. In other words, what this bracha is reminding us, and something that is unfortunately often forgotten, the role of individuality in Judaism. Yes, the Torah can and should relate to me personally. It can happen. Because the message that Torah, that God has to communicate to me today, I can plug into through Torah. And I pray to God, speak to me today. Through the text. Through the learning. Speak to me today. Make it sweet in our mouths. And we and our children and children, well, we all know. We will know your name. Basically, what we have here is a proof for what I should be aspiring to achieve through Torah. One thing, know your name. Oh, come on. Is there anybody here who doesn't know God's name? God, I know it. I have to spend, you know, years and years and years of study to know God's name. You see, as I mentioned before, the Zohar says, the entire Torah is God's name. And to know God's name means to learn how to call. Learn how to call. Learn how to evoke that presence in our life. And make that kind of connection. And unfortunately, you can sometimes find people, you know, they're supposed to be quote-unquote religious. And you don't understand why they behave the way they behave. Because they study so much Torah. That's the problem. They study Torah. They're not involved. They never prayed and said, please Hashem. I mean, they might have said these words, but please Hashem, make it sweet. Today, it should be perfectly relating to me and what I need to hear today. You know, this is a prayer that we have. Tein chalkeinu b'Torah techa. Give us our portion in the Torah. Rav Kook, you know, said an amazing thing. Bielik, who is a Yiddish author, right, Yiddish poet and author, Bielik came from a religious home. Now, Bielik wrote one of the most outstanding texts on Agadah, on Jewish Midrashic literature. And it's called Sefer Agadah, and most rabbis probably have it because it's an amazing resource book. You want to prepare any class, you look in the index, and you can find a tremendous selection of sources on any topic you're looking for. It's an amazing piece. Amazing piece. I remember when I bought this piece and I opened it at the front page and there is Bielik sitting there with, I cannot remember who else he wrote the book with or researched with, and they're both sitting there and they're not wearing kippahs. I was shocked. I mean, here's a person who had such a love and understanding of Agadah, produced this text and doesn't even have a kippah on his head, studying it. Well, how does that kind of thing happen? How could this man have such an interest in the Torah and yet on the other hand, didn't seem to... I don't know what he incorporated. It's very likely he incorporated things that is his own secret and nobody knows. But he hasn't been identified so much as an Orthodox Jew anyways. You see, Rav Kook said this about Bielik. He said, Bielik, his portion in Torah was obviously Agada. And probably in the yeshiva that he went to when he was a kid, he was not made to feel that that is integral to Torah. Because unfortunately, what can happen in yeshiva is we learn just Gemara, 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 as if other parts of Torah is not part of Torah. I have to tell you, when I was in a particular yeshiva, I was on a bus going to the yeshiva, and sits beside me, I call Lil Nick from the yeshiva. He says to me, what is your Seder Hayom? What is your curriculum of the day that you're studying? So I told him, well, I'm learning Gemara, I'm learning Halacha, and I've decided that I'm going to spend every single day an hour and a half on Chumash, on learning the five books of Moses. And this guy looked at me and said, what? Bittul Torah? Wasting time from Torah learning? I'm not joking. I didn't know what he's talking about. But it got that bad for this guy that he thought that if a person was to dedicate an hour and a half to Chumash, that this is a waste of time from really studying Judaism. It can get that crazy sometimes. Hopefully he is an individual. Bielik did not have the vote of confidence of his rebbes, perhaps, that Agada is your portion in Torah. And it's a sad thing. But this is what we're praying for. Make it sweet in our mouths. Make it relate to us. So we can know your name. So we can call out. And thereby learn Torah for its sake. If a person is involved in Torah, because they're really interested in meeting the author, feeling the presence, making that connection, plugging in, then they're learning Torah l'shma, and then they fulfill the bracha, hamilamed, he who is teaching right now Torah to his nation Israel.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990. or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.